It's time for the Listening Shires Arts Magazine calendar. Bennington Museum presents Milton Avery's Vermont this week through November 6th. This exhibition takes the first focused look at the work this great American modernist created during those summers spent in southern Vermont between 1935 and 1943. For more info, BenningtonMuseum.org. Old Castle Theater this week through August 21st presents City of Conversation, a play by Anthony Giardina. This exciting play premiered at Lincoln Center 2 years ago and is a must-see event for this summer. For more info, oldcastletheater.org. Hubbard Hall, August 10th, 12th, and 13th at 7 p.m. Madame Butterfly, Puccini's heartbreaking opera of Betrayal and a Mother's Pain. For more info, hubbardhall.org. As always, tune in to the Listening Shire Sundays 8 to 12 noon and Art Magazine Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Give us a like on Facebook.
This is the Listening Shires over WBTN AM 1370, your community-supported radio station, WBTNAM.org, for streaming on the web or on our very own WBTN AM app. My name is Thomas Lawrence Toscano, and I have here an interview that I did with Lila Brown, the founder of Music at Salem 30 years ago. It's a very, very interesting story, a wonderful interview. She's went away for some well-deserved respite, and we talked to each other on the phone this week in the evening to record this interview for you all. So enjoy it, and we will see each other on the other side. We don't need that there. Music from Salem is a local ensemble. It is an ensemble that has been around, as I said, for 30 years and has gone through a number of... It's grown, as anything else that's around for 30 years has grown. Created in their very own barn, farm property that they bought... somewhat before 30 years ago, 33, 34, I don't know that she was specific. And it's been a stable of concerts containing some of the best chamber music players in the world, supported by a group of extremely enthusiastic board members and staff members, etc. And it's truly something that is worthy of our support, and I hope you learned things about this wonderful ensemble that you have not known before, and listen to who this person truly is who was at the beginning of all of this. This is the Listening Shires over WBTN AM 1370, your community-supported radio station, WBTNAM.org, for streaming on the web or on our very own WBTN app, which you can procure at the Google Play Store or the iTunes App Store. My name is Thomas Lawrence Toscano, and as always, each week, my pleasure to present to you the great Dennis Brain playing the opening horn solo to Britten's Serenade for Tenor, Horn, and Strings, a great musician, orchestral soloist, and chamber musician. We have another great chamber musician on the line. I am here and very thrilled and privileged to have Lila Brown, one of the founders of Music from Salem, and we are about to imbibe on yet another historical conversation. Good morning, Lila.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you.
On the Listening Shires, we have a very simple formula that we follow, and the formula goes as such. Before we get to the doing, we speak about and listen to your words, that is to say, the being. So would you tell us about your childhood and your education and how it got you to where you are today?
Sure. I grew up about half an hour from Yale University in Connecticut. It happened that the head of the string department lived in my town, and he wanted to start experimental classes for little kids, which his students at Yale in the graduate program would come out and learn on us by teaching us. And my parents heard about it somehow. So when I was six, I started going to these wildly experimental classes. and they were a lot of fun. And when I was 8, they said, time to start the violin. Nobody asked me if I wanted to play the viola, but I was able to discover that later.
Who was the professor?
Brodus Earl.
Ah, yes. I remember him. Yeah. He was still there when I was there.
Yes.
Oh, what a wonderful man.
Incredibly charismatic.
Yes.
And so it was all a bit wonderfully chaotic, but fun. I think that was the key word. So later in life, when I was 15, I was a very serious little poet, but I got to playing some chamber music with people again at that age, and I realized this would be a heck of a lot more fun. That's how it all got started. And, you know, my parents kept the thread going somehow. I wasn't a big practicer or especially dedicated until I turned 15. But that's the thing to do if you have kids playing an instrument. Just keep that thread going somehow.
Yes, I remember I stopped playing for about a year.
And really?
Yeah, one day my mother came in and she said, you'll never play again. And I turned to her and I looked at her and I said, don't say that. You don't know that. Soon after that, I began to play again and I never stopped.
Yeah.
Those transition ages can be very difficult. What happened at 15 that you began to take it seriously, as it were, become more involved in practicing?
Well, I had the great fortune to go to a private school where they were taking the arts very seriously. The school doesn't exist anymore. It was in Washington, Connecticut, called Wickham Rise. And they gave scholarships to 5 kids at the Juilliard Pre-College. So I just happened to be able to sort of slip into that. I was just good enough to play chamber music with them. And that was my ticket kind of into the real music scene, because I hadn't, you know, my parents were not musicians and I didn't know any other, anybody in that world, really.
Sure.
And they all told me, oh, you should go study with this person and that. And also, it's an age where you're searching for something, and I wanted some discipline and some intense, you know, I started practicing, and I just found this passion for, you know, I practiced the Bach Chaconne for an hour and a half a day. It seemed like an amazing long amount of time, but I loved that, being alone and just working with, trying to work something out and get better at something through my own, you know, your own wits and discipline. And
something inside of you driving you to connect.
Yeah. So, and also the routine of it, you know, something that when you're at that age, I don't know about you, but I was pretty lost emotionally, you know.
Oh,
and,
certainly.
Yeah, and you've got something that you're going to do every day no matter what, and it centers you and it gives you something, structure. And so it's a nice combination of that, going in a room alone and practicing, and then being able to get together with other people and just make this incredible music together. And I still find practicing to be incredibly calming and centering. You have to focus completely. You close everything else out. And I think there's also something about the vibrations of an instrument. The physical aspect is healing, I think.
And this, of course, was all still, I'm assuming, on violin.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't get viola until, let's see, the end of college. I was in a string trio. We were looking for a violist, and we couldn't find the right person. And I thought, it can't be that hard to play the viola. Now I know better. But my teacher at that time happened to be also violin and viola, and someone had made her a viola and given it to her. And I called her up and I said, I kind of like to try myself. She said, oh, you can borrow this viola. That was over Christmas vacation. And then I never took out the violin again. I just loved, I found my voice with the viola.
Seriously.
Yeah.
What happened?
That's a good question. I just think everybody has an instrument, you know, that matches their temperament. For instance, I have a low voice.
Yes.
Voice,
yes,
so
you do.
I, you know, the high violin thing was a strain for me. And I grew up, my father was not a musician, but he played a lot of wonderful Guarneri quartet recordings. And, you know, the viola in the chamber piece often plays, has all those special moments,
yes.
You know, harmony turns or something happens. And the viola is acoustically interesting because it's actually kind of handicapped compared to a violin and a cello. It should be much longer for
yes.
how low it is.
Yes.
So that gives it that sort of struggling quality, and that just suits me. And it's a melancholy, you know. There's something very human about the range of the instrument, and something about having to really work to get the sound out. I don't know. It just clicked with me.
I understand. Let's take a short pause here, a few words from some of our friends, some advice and information, and we'll return in a moment with Lila Brown. This is the Listening Shires over WBTN AM 1370, your community-supported radio station, WBTNAM.org for streaming on the web. Or on our very own WBTN app, which you can get at the Google Play or iTunes app stores. I'm here on the line with Lila Brown, the mind, the reality behind, one of them, behind Music from Salem. But she has an awfully long history with this group. And something, this is odd for a conductor to say, but she's one of those precious beings who plays viola. And I say that because the viola section, as was demonstrated by the great Carlo Maria Giulini, who was a violist in the orchestra and then became a conductor, and I had the privilege of studying with him once in my life, the great ability to hear within the orchestra the great inner sound, that sound that is constantly switching roles, and the plaintive sound, the little sister to the cello and the older sister to the violin, but it's sort of the ugly sister in a sense, because it's just not quite the right reality, the right shape, and yet it is such an important, and a very, very important aspect to orchestral and chamber music. And if you doubt what I say, just go up the hill, Bennington College, this week for the next couple of weeks. There's the Chamber Music Festival. You'll hear some string quartets, and you'll hear the viola, and you'll understand. So now you studied with, who did you study with?
Wait, I just have to challenge what you said about the ugly sister.
Well,
I would say the challenge sister, because it's just because it's acoustically doesn't project as easily. Is it?
You know, you're right. Ugly wasn't the right word. You know, it's the sister that sits in the corner and has her hair in a bun and maybe glasses. But when someone gives attention and allows her to be who she really is, there's this enormous depth and beauty. And so there you go. That's the way to say it. Who did you study with once you left now and you become an adult? You studied with some very powerful people. Could you talk to us a little bit about them?
Yes. Well, as I said, as a child, I was lucky to have all these Yale grad students, most of whom became very renowned, both Yoko Matsuda and Shoko Aki.
Yes, I knew her as well.
Both played in the Yale String Quartet at different times. And
yes.
Peter Salas was my very first teacher, who played in the Cleveland String Quartet.
Oh, my God, I remember him, too.
Yeah, and they were all just students. And Daniel Stepner, who plays in the Lydian String Quartet. Interesting, actually. They all became quartet players.
Yes. And they taught a little quartet player who now you are a big quartet player. Or chamber music player.
Yes, yeah. Then after I met those kids at school, I went to play for Dorothy DeLay, and she had a wonderful assistant named Patty Kopeck.
Oh, wow.
And she sort of straightened me all out technically for a long, for 4 years I studied with her, and then I spent some wonderful summers at Aspen studying with Don Weilerstein. And then went to Juilliard on viola with William Linzer, who was 40 years principal of the New York Philharmonic.
Yes.
Wonderful teacher. And then I played in the Boston Symphony for a few years, and I decided I wanted to study again in Europe with Sándor Bég. He was a Hungarian violinist. He was at Marlborough. He played a lot with Kossoff at the end of his life. He had the well-known Bég Quartet, another quartet player. And, that was the last. I spent a year in Salzburg with him.
Well, and it's he that I really want to ask you about, because Sándor Bég, I do a lot on the show to talk about the lineage of musicians.
Uh-huh.
And I've known about him for quite a long time, mostly because of the fact that he was the favorite of Carlos Kleiber in terms of conductors, which was very interesting given all the great conductors there were that had come before, including his own father. In his opinion, Sándor Bég was of the greatest conductors, a man completely filled with music. And that's a big deal for Carlos Kleiber to say. His teacher was Ube. And he studied violin with Ube and composition with Kodály. And, of course, Ube was a student of Joachim and was involved with Liszt. And Liszt told him to go ahead and make his debut in France. And that's when he met Henri Vuitton, and they created the Budapest Quartet. And so there's all this history that you are a part of. Your lineage is part of that lineage. What was it like studying with Sándor Bég?
Well, it was the musical high point of my life. That was an incredible year. We all went to master class almost every day. You'd sit there and try to gather your nerves, waiting for your time to stand up and play.
Wow.
But you got to learn from hearing him teaching everybody. And we also played in his chamber orchestra, the Camerata Accademica.
Yes.
So that was like having another lesson, and we had many, many, many rehearsals. So it's interesting what Kleiber says, because he actually was not a trained conductor at all. He didn't have any conducting technique. But he knew how to rehearse, and he had something to say. I mean, he knew he would come to every rehearsal of every little Mozart serenade or cassation that he'd done a million times. He'd come to every single rehearsal and he'd say, "I was looking at the score last night and I noticed this or that," and we'd start at a certain little place and he would have found some little gem in there, something about the inner voices or the articulation. So that was a profound musical experience.
And you were there for a year.
Yes, and he always said we have to carry on the tradition of the Middle European school, the Franco-Belgian school. It's a lot about articulation, and he was always talking about how we have to carry that on, pass that on. So it's interesting you put it that way.
Yes. This is a difficult question to answer, but how much do you think that he transformed you at that time of your life, because you were no longer a beginner, certainly. My God, you'd already played in the Boston Symphony.
Right, but I knew there was something missing. And at that time, an orchestra like the BSO was still playing Mozart and Haydn, even Brahms, in a pretty old-fashioned, kind of like a big soup, and I had a feeling there was something missing, and I always wanted to learn German, because that's what so many of the composers' language comes from, that language.
Yes.
So I went over there really hungry, and I'd just been playing, working in an orchestra for 2.5 years, and I really am a chamber musician at heart, and I just was so hungry to get new experiences and the first day when I sat down in the Camerata and played the first little solo in the Bartók Divertimento, he stopped the whole group and he said, "Boston is far from Hungary." So I was doing my Juilliard best, but
right.
And so he just opened a whole new world. He was always talking about schwung, which was swing.
Yes.
A way of using the bow so that the music would ring and swing. And
yes.
It just was irresistible, so compelling.
Let's take a short break here, allow the audience to digest that reality, and we'll return in a moment with Lila Brown and more fascinating conversation.
Yes, and this is the Listening Shires over WBTN AM 1370. I'm going to interrupt this interview just to welcome Armstrong's Farm Stand to our airwaves and thank them very much for their support of Morning Coffee with the Wolf. And also to thank everyone who came to our listener appreciation barbecue on Saturday. On Friday. No, it was on Friday. Lots of barbecuing, and I had the pleasure of doing that. And many people were here. Many, many people were here. We had a wonderful, wonderful time. Stay tuned to the next one, and do join us. It's going to be even bigger and better. Now back to our interview.
This is the Listening Shires over WBTN AM 1370, your community-supported radio station, WBTNAM.org for streaming on the web or on our very own WBTN app. Get it at Google Play or the iTunes Store. I'm here with Lila Brown. And Lila, I have a question to ask you that comes out of my own very experience. I started my studies at the University of Denver, and then I moved on to New England Conservatory, and then moved on to Yale and got 3 degrees. And the more I moved on, the more I focused on conducting. And of course, to me, the orchestra, the orchestra, the orchestra. I did a lot of chamber music and did a lot of chamber performing and was actually singing in all of this, which was a very weird way to live my life, being a orchestral conductor and a singer. But I certainly knew about legato. And I remember very clearly at NEC, at Yale, many people. There were those people who clearly were going towards an orchestral life. They were going to audition. They were preparing for Los Angeles, New York, Seattle, wherever. They got their job, and many of them are still playing. They're coming to the ends of their careers, and they've had wonderful lives, and they're very fulfilled. Great.
Yeah.
But there were those people who just knew, this is not for me. Are you going to audition? Oh, no. What do you mean, no? I'm not playing in an orchestra. Really? No. I'm going to play chamber music. So this must have had something to do with the creation of Music from Salem. That great desire amongst so many to play chamber music. Talk to us about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it is just the urge to interpret, to keep exploring the music and go in depth. You know, orchestras never have enough money or time, except for when we were with Vaig, and he just took the time and we didn't get the money.
or unless you're lucky enough to be in Munich with 18 rehearsals per concert.
Yes, exactly. You don't have the time to go into something in great depth. And when you're playing chamber music, you take the whole thing in your own hands. You decide how much time you're going to spend and what you're going to explore about it, and then you get to sing your part with your own individual voice. You know, when you're part of a group of 12 players playing the same line, it's a beautiful thing to blend and become one, but you have to give up your own interpretation of, you know, how that melody should be phrased or articulated. So, yeah, and then also, I mean, there are 9 great Beethoven symphonies, but there are all the great string quartets and the trios, and there's just this incredible wealth of masterpieces in chamber music.
And that's only Beethoven.
Yeah, I mean, everybody, yeah.
Yes.
Someone like Schubert, his great output with songs, but both, you know, also the symphonies and the chamber music are incredible. I mean, I like the chance in Boston to play the occasional symphony as well, but Yeah, my passion is for chamber music, and I had the good fortune to go to the Marlboro Festival when I was 26, and that was the most sort of intense, serious chamber music work I'd done up to that point. And so I think that was one of the big inspirations for me to start my own festival. And that's also been an inspiration that we keep things at Music from Salem, that we have time. We take almost 6 days, 5 or 6 days, to prepare one program, which is a lot. You know, we could do it on the second day, but we tear everything apart again, and we are able to do repertoire, which isn't just a standard fare that everybody knows already, and you can just sit down and kind of play it down. So people are discovering things and rediscovering new things in the famous works, and it stays really exciting. This summer, I feel, it's one of the best we've ever had after 30 years, because, I got an email from one of our players this summer who's in a well-known string quartet, who said it's always, there's something about the otherness of being at Music from, there are selvesness of being at Music from Salem, he said, because we're undisturbed, just five of us there, just working on the music. And he said somehow it brings out the best in each of us. And that it means so much to me that someone who plays regularly, plays chamber music, still finds something special about it. It's a sort of small island of dedication to chamber works that we kind of allow for people in the summer.
A refuge, as it were, of life as it's supposed to be.
Yeah,
you know, life as it was in the 18th and 19th centuries and early 20th century before the Great Wars, where this is what you did. When this was your job, this was your job. That's what you did.
Yeah, maybe it's a little bit silly, but before we got internet at the farm, we were always very slow, you know, to get a fax and then to get internet. And the day we got internet there, I walked into the kitchen and there was one of my colleagues with her computer at the table, and my heart sank. And we had a quick discussion about it, and those of us who, you know, I also have two wonderful consulting directors, Rhonda Ryder and Judith Gordon, and we had a discussion, and we said, let's just decide to keep these things out of the social areas, out of the kitchen and the living room, and we stick with that. And again, it's sort of, so people know when they come there that if they're in the room with other people, we're gonna be interacting with each other, and that isn't a constant presence. The online thing, we have internet; they can go to the room, you know, across the street, and do it. But it's part of a sort of quiet and focus.
Time to connect in a different way, at a different level.
And the nice thing is that it really shows up, comes out in the concerts, and our audience recognizes it, and they're part of it. They bring the same kind of listening and expectation, and so there's a very special atmosphere.
That's no surprise, given the kinds of concerts that you put on. Now, you all congregate at a specific place. You all are actually in Salem for the summer.
We have week-long sessions, so we do we have different groups each week, but for instance, Judith Gordon plays piano for two or three of the weeks, and I'm there each time because everyone's staying at my house there.
Uh-huh.
But otherwise, we have a sort of wonderful pool of people who come maybe every 2 years, or, you know, it totally varies. We've had many wonderful players who've gone on to have big solo careers, and people kind of rotate around.
How did it start?
My mother and I went up to, we had this sort of romantic idea of getting an old farmhouse in Vermont. I grew up in a modern house, and my mother was an architectural historian, So we just went wandering around, and everything in Vermont was expensive and already renovated, and she was wise, and she said, let's just go over the border and see what happens. So we went over the border to New York, and the prices dropped $500 an acre, and we landed at this realtor's place just where we landed when we drove over the border, and he said, yeah, I have a place to show you. And it was March, and it was muddy and horrible, and but my mother had a vision, and she knew that it was an incredible piece of land and that the buildings were historic. They just needed a lot of help. And so she bought it for a song, spent several years restoring, and then she didn't know what to do with it anymore. So they wanted to sell it, but I had this idea of having a music festival. And so at that time, my co-founder was Judith Eisenberg, who plays in the Lydian String Quartet. And we just sent out 7 letters to people in the area, kind of asking, what do you think we should, where should we play, who should we talk to? And everyone pointed us towards Hubbard Hall in Cambridge, New York. And it is a gem of a building with a
yes,
really rare acoustics. And Benji White was the director there for many, many years. We walked in, and he had just let go his chamber group that he had playing there, and he said, sure. So, yeah, that's how we got started. We started with just one concert, and strangely enough, that was the year that I moved to Europe, but somehow, you know, that was before email and everything. We one day he called me up in Germany, and he said, no, Austria, and he said, well, you need a board, so I made you a board. So he put together a little group, and, you know, so that we could apply for some
grants,
local NISCA funding, and
sure,
so on, you know. And we've had amazing community support, you know, board, rotating board members step up every time I think, oh my gosh, everyone who's that dedicated has already given what they can give, but somehow new people keep coming on, and 30 years, we're still going strong. So
how marvelous. Let's take a short pause and return in a moment with Lila Brown. This is the Listening Shire. This is the Listening Shires over WBTN AM 1370, your community-supported radio station, WBTNAM.org, for streaming on the web or on our very own WBTN app, which you can get at Google Play or at the iTunes App Store. My name is Thomas Lawrence Toscano, and I'm here with Lila Brown on the Listening Shires Arts Magazine this Sunday morning, and we've been talking about the joy of chamber music, the reality of music from Salem, which has been, is now celebrating 30 years of chamber music.
That's right, 30.
30 yeah. years of chamber music. You know, I have to tell you something. When I lived in Brazil, I started a Camarata Suzuki with Suzuki kids. And it was all the instruments, all the string instruments. And I conducted the orchestra for 2 or 3 years, the remaining 2 or 3 years that I stayed in Brazil. And then in 93, I left. Well, the orchestra is still going strong, I'm very happy to say, but I did not have the experience of being with it this long. When we started the orchestra in the wintertime, and this is a part of Brazil where it gets very cold, in the wintertime, we took them all to a farm, and we put them in bunk beds, and we had a week-long mini Tanglewood. We had professors come in, and they played, and they talked, and we rehearsed chamber music, we rehearsed orchestral music, their orchestral music, Baroque, some classical, etc., and had such an astounding time that I still get Facebook messages and connections from the children who are now all adults, some of whom have musical careers, some of them big musical careers, and talking about how it made such a difference to them. But this was a one-time thing, which, of course, at that moment, I'm sure I was thrilling over the idea that, oh, maybe this could become a new Brazilian Tanglewood or whatever. And, of course, it was once. But you've done this for 30 years. Did you have a notion that that would happen when you began?
Nope. And no, you just have to start somewhere and then see what happens.
And see what happens.
Yeah. But, I mean, and now we have focused gradually more on educational aspects, of course. It's, you know, we've become older, and all of us are teaching. We have a viola, violin seminar and a cello seminar for a week each in June. The cello seminar focuses on contemporary music. Rhonda Ryder runs that, and Judith Gordon and David Russell and Scott Kluckstall is all taught there. So now that we have only 11 students at that, so it must be a similar thing to what you're describing in Brazil. And three faculty, and there you are in a beautiful farmhouse, and there's nothing institutional about it. That's what I love.
Right.
And you have this incredible nature, and all the creatures.
Yes.
You know, and yeah, so it really is a whole different experience from school, you know.
Yes, certainly. Do you have a barn hall where you rehearse and perform for yourselves?
We have a studio, one of the loft of one of the barns, and that's where we got the grand piano up there somehow. Also, you have that wonderful experience, as you were describing, of the living together.
Yes.
There's a certain rhythm to the week, the first night and the second night and the third night and the night after the children's workshop and the open rehearsal, and each group gets its own dynamic, and definitely has a big effect on your rehearsal the next day when you've been bonding over dinner the night before. You know, it's a whole different thing than just meeting in the city at a certain time and everyone comes from their hectic other life, and everyone gives themselves to that group for the week, and that is special and different.
So there's 7-day incursions, as it were.
Almost six, yeah.
They're rotating members and rotating participants.
Yeah, I put together the groups and asked the people, you know, out of a wonderful pool that we have developed over the years, you know, and I look for who would be good for a particular kind of piece or with another person or what might be an interesting, you know, I like to introduce people to each other that haven't known each other. Even within Boston, there's so many wonderful musicians who've not played with each other. Then there's somebody who has a passion for a certain music, and they tell me about a piece they want to do, and so that's a place to let them do the piece that they are, you know, keen to do. I mean, if I may just mention a few pieces that I've discovered.
Of course.
Over the years, that, for instance, there are certain pieces of Dach 90 that everybody knows, but his string quartets are not as well known. And actually, one of my students told me, "Hey, I just heard this incredible recording, his third string quartet. I listened to it and we scheduled it, and it's very tricky, and you can't put it together in 2 days. But it's just a fabulous piece, and the audience didn't know it, and we didn't know it, and we were able to do this amazing, unusual piano quintet by Roy Harris."
Oh, wow.
Quite tricky, yeah. And we did Zemlinsky's second string quartet, which, again, is not like standard festival fare. And both the late piano quintets of Fauré, you know, everyone knows the piano quartets, but not so much the quintets. So there have been so many wonderful discoveries. There's a crazy piece by Martineau, a fantasy for theremin and oboe and string quartet and piano, which we did with somebody who invented their own instrument called an utterbot, which is a Coke bottle with a bottom sawed off and a rubber glove on the bottom, and you can make pitches and you amplify it a little bit and it sounds almost exactly like a theremin. And you know, that's not a piece you get to hear usually on a chamber music program. And also Martineau's second piano quintet, I didn't know before. It's just off slightly, you know, off the central track of the usual Brahms sextets and the things that you hear, you know, a standard festival fare. And I think audiences come especially also because they know they're going to hear something on almost every program that they've not heard before. But I'm pretty careful to only put on things that are really good, you know.
Have you programmed any of the music of Grażyna Bąsiewicz, the Polish female composer? I had Joanna Kurkowicz on the show 2 months ago at least. And we had the most wonderful conversation and I played all of the violin concerto that she recorded. And she has 4 string quartets and suites for 2 violins, a trio for oboe, clarinet, and bassoon. A lot of music, very worthwhile looking into. Quartet, listen to this one, quartet for 4 violins.
Oh, yeah, I have heard that, yes.
I haven't heard that one. I'm still trying to find it. Wonderful that you're doing that kind of programming because, of course, this is what we were talking about before. There's so much chamber music. And you get...
Yeah, you can always discover a new masterpiece.
Yes.
Incredible.
Yes, it really is. It really, really is. Not to say that there's something wrong with returning to the sextets or something.
We just played Dvorak Piano Quintet on Sunday.
There you go.
And we all had one of the best experiences with it we've ever had, which is also wonderful, just to, you know, get a fresh take on a more standard piece.
Very quickly, we're going to run out of time, but I wanted to ask you this question. How have these 30 years changed you as a performer, as a violist, as a person?
I would say mostly as a person because it's been the most consistent community experience of my life. In other words, dealing with people who live there, people who've devoted themselves to us by being on our board or helping out in different ways, and the responsibility you feel towards those people and towards the community. You know, musicians are all over the globe and they don't tend to stay in one place. And that's been a sort of sense of permanence and of community and the depth of the meaning of what a good community is, which it's taught me so much. Humility and compassion, I think, for what everybody does and has to offer. And that's been the greatest gift for me from the whole thing. I mean, it's wonderful to be able to choose the music and choose the people and have these fulfilling musical experiences, but it's been the whole package. The responsibility of kind of seeing it through and learning to work with everyone in the community that's been the greatest learning experience for me.
When you give performances at Hubbard Hall, do you also give pre-performances in and around Salem?
Yes, we do. Well, we have an open rehearsal every week at the farm. That's free. We do children and youth workshops, which are free every week. There's a youth center in Greenwich, New York, and we do workshops for something called Lunch, Learn, and Play in Salem at the courthouse. Yeah, those are our community offerings.
And you are within the borders, as it were, of Salem itself. You're not off somewhere else. You're not in Greenwich or in Hebron.
They call it Greenwich. We have the open rehearsal in Salem, and we perform in Cambridge, New York. Yeah.
Wow.
And I also just want to add that the concerts are also pay what you will, pay what you can, because we really just want people to come. I mean, you know, it takes so much to support an organization like this. It's recommended $25 if you have it, but I want people to come if they can afford $5. Much rather have them come than not come, you know.
Yes. And you have one more performance in the season?
Yes, we do. The Sunday after this on August 14th at 4 p.m.
So next Sunday, August 14th at 4 p.m. at Hubbard Hall.
Right.
Upstairs in the Opera House.
Yes.
And the program is going to be?
We start with a little Schubert string trio and then Prokofiev Sonata for two violins.
Oh, wow.
And that's where I had fun putting together two power women, Katie Lansdale and Solomia Ivakiv, who I didn't know if they'd played together before. It turns out they had, but I sort of envisioned that. So I'm looking forward to that. And then we do these incredible little Dvorak string quartet pieces called Cypresses. I don't know if you know those.
The Dvorak, yeah, a long time ago.
He wrote them first as a set of love songs, so that the poems are unrequited love poems. And he wrote the songs when he was very young, and then he revisited it when he was older, found the music was good, and turned them into string quartets, little mini string quartets. Most of them are on Dante's. They're very gentle, most incredible, touching little pieces. So we'll do four of those, and then we finish with the Glazunov string quintet with two cellos.
Oh, marvelous.
Glazunov birthday year, so.
Yes. Yes, I played some Glazunov a couple of weeks ago.
It
has been, as I anticipated, a great joy speaking with you. Thank you so much for being a part of our ongoing broadcasts. It truly means the world to me.
Thank you for just reaching out and finding us. This is wonderful.
Well, this is all through Teresa and of course her husband Adriano and the pilot that I was involved in this past week with Artful Vagabond Productions and up at the Tilting Windmills Gallery up in Manchester. And it's just been what a find, what a beautiful echo, that's a ripple that's come out of that experience into this experience. So thank you so much. I hope to make it on the 14th. My friends, do not miss this performance. You know that I am very pushy. I am constantly telling you what to do, and this is something that you must do. Get up. Go to Cambridge and attend this concert, because
you're
just not going to hear it very often. Thank you so much, Lila. This was truly a wonderful and delightful conversation. I thank Teresa, their administrator, for helping put us all together. And I thank Lila for joining us. It was a wonderful experience indeed. And very graciously sharing her time with me on vacation. So do attend the concert next week. It is something that you will never forget. We will return, my friends, with surprises.